Hello and welcome to Obsession, where we get horribly obsessed, highly obsessed, hilariously obsessed with things that other people might find odd. Nothing is too obscure, too creepy, or too weird for us to research obsessively. I'm Heidi.
And I'm Rebecca.
Join us in being obsessed.
Hello, Heidi.
Hi, Becky.
Hi, everyone. How are you? Hello. Welcome back. Look at us. Three times in a row we have pulled out a podcast.
I know. And, you know, I think this is episode 29 overall. So we're going to have to do something special for our 30.
Oh, 30. Ah, yeah. We will. Ever think we'd make it to 30?
No, I thought we might make it. I thought we might make it to 5.
Yep. This is pretty good for two Geminis.
Oh, so good.
Oh, and it's
Gemini season at the moment, so.
Winter.
Yeah.
It's winter in Australia and we're all cozying up.
Yes.
You've been curling up and keeping warm?
I have been, yes.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yes. Curling up, lots of naps. It's great.
It's nice. So, shall we podcast? Because I like this topic today.
Yes.
It's really interesting.
It's actually a really nice, light topic.
Yeah, I think we needed one of those. So, no one's faces is getting ripped off. Well, actually, anyway, one's faces, no real people's faces are being ripped off.
In a non-violent way.
It is better. It is safe. It is safe. You can listen without fear of nightmares, because I do believe we may have given one of our listeners a few nightmares recently.
Oh, I think we did.
Yeah, sorry about that. This one's fine.
Yes. So, Becky. When I say iconic paintings, what are the first few that just immediately flash into your head?
The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles people. So Donatello, Da Vinci, or Rubens, Picasso, you know, the big names.
All right. What do you think is the most famous painting in Western art history?
Well, that is super easy.
Yeah.
The Mona Lisa.
Great.
Everyone knows the Mona Lisa.
And I was hoping you'd say that. Because we are actually talking about the Mona Lisa.
Surprise, surprise.
I know. And, you know, the thing about an iconic painting, or any iconic images really, is that they become a sort of visual cliche. And it's really hard sometimes to understand why they're considered such a big deal in the first place. With time, we really lose the idea of what made them shocking or revolutionary. And the endless reproductions of these images just make them part of the furniture of our brains. Mm. You know, if you think of Van Gogh's Sunflowers.
Yeah.
If you think of Munch's The Scream, if you think of
Toby crying,
yes. Yeah. It, and of course, if you think of the Mona Lisa,
so totally agree with you there. I often question how some painting, while of course brilliant, not saying they're not, are somehow set up as the epitome of art, when I would probably consider other works to be, you know. So whether that's subjective or just playing what society has told us is brilliant. Like, I hate Hemingway, and I'm sorry, Virginia Woolf bores me to tears. I'm like, I can't see why they're iconic writers, but they have somehow made the list of, you know, that's iconic. And I think the same thing with art.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So today, as I said, we're going to take probably the most famous image in Western art, which is the Mona Lisa by Leonardo da Vinci. And we're going to explore how a work of art can become famous to the point that it belongs in the collective consciousness as the symbol of Western art.
So we know that there are endless conspiracy theories about the identity of Lisa or the reason for the smile or all those things. And of course, there's even more bizarre conspiracy theories. We are more interested today in how people as a collective force choose an image to become iconic and what that says about us. So, mm-hmm. Heidi, about 80% of the current visitors to the Louvre in Paris do so with the sole intention of seeing Mona Lisa, in spite of the fact that the Louvre is packed to the brim with masterworks, 38,000. And so we ask, why? Is it because that is much better than the other works in the other gallery? Is it because people report having profound emotional responses when looking at her? Is it because they like Dan Brown and read the Da Vinci Code? And what do they think when they actually see her?
Well, I can answer for myself there because I have been to the Louvre and I have seen the Mona Lisa.
And was it a profound experience?
No, it really wasn't.
No.
There was a sea of tourists with phones and cameras, and I basically stood for ages in this sweaty pool of people to get up close enough to see her. And she looked pretty much like she does in the postcards. So it's basically like seeing a larger version of the postcards.
So was it worth navigating this social hell or was it disappointing?
Look, I wouldn't say disappointing because I'd expected as much. And I didn't go there just to see her. You know, I'd already heard that it was an underwhelming experience. To be honest, I was a lot more interested in a lot of the other things in the Louvre, which is incredible, by the way. If you do get the chance to go, please go and please schedule like an entire day or an entire couple of days because there is a lot.
See, I'd be radical here, and I've got to be honest with you. I'm not just saying this because of the podcast. I actually don't think I'd bother with the Mona Lisa if I went there. I think I'd be more interested in the other wealth of stuff they have there.
Yeah, the thing is, when you're there, you're like, well, I may as well. I'm here. You know? It's almost impossible to avoid because there are just so many people there. It's not really something you can ignore.
You know, this may surprise you, but while we were researching this particular obsession, I went on another obsession, which was trying to figure out what Chagall work, the Louvre had.
Oh.
And trying to navigate their website and trying to get away from the Mona Lisa is actually like
impossible. Oh my God.
The entire website's just Mona Lisa. I still don't know what Chagall's they have there. But anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, no, I don't think I would actually do it. I mean, I can see why people would because it's like, you know, I've been there, I've seen it. But I don't know. I don't like tourists. So,
yeah.
All right. So on that point, was the painting itself underwhelming or the experience of being mashed up with all the other tourists?
Look, honestly, I wasn't close enough to the painting to experience anything. And when I was kind of close enough to appreciate it, I was just kind of pushed past by the crowd. So I can't really separate the painting from the experience, which was a bit annoying.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So, well, I might like to see if I was alone in a room, I could sit in front of it.
Totally.
Quietly. But I think that whole tourist thing would kill it, which is kind of what we're talking about tonight. So the big question is the Mona Lisa overrated?
Okay. I wouldn't say overrated. I would say overused, overexposed.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is, like a lot of other things that are iconic, she's become separated from her historical context, which is important, and she's ended up famous for being famous.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Yeah, so like Mona Lisa Kardashian. No, I'm just joking. I actually do think this is an exceptional painting, but the fame is not because it's an exceptional painting.
So something that might shock people to know is that the Mona Lisa wasn't always a famous painting.
Ah, absolutely. So the painting is around 500 years old and it's only been really, really famous for a bit over 100 years, which is kind of hard for us to imagine. It kind of feels like one of those eternal things. So for centuries before that, it was appreciated by art critics and art historians, but the average person on the street with only a passing interest in art probably wouldn't have recognized her in a lineup of other paintings, which is amazing because it feels like her face has always been in the public consciousness as this example of unquestionable genius and artistic perfection. And in reality, even Leonardo da Vinci wasn't always held up as an intellectual superhuman like he is now.
No, he was actually considered a bit of a loser during most of his adult life.
He was the very definition of a sad, washed up former child prodigy. And that makes me love him. Because I used to have this idea that he was always revered and always respected. And the more I research his life, the more relatable he becomes.
And you know what else? He was even more of a procrastinator than we are, Heidi.
Yeah.
Our regular podcast schedule, Da Vinci behavior. He was disorganized, he was messy, and so unreliable that when it came to finishing commissions, nobody wanted to hire him. He had so many interests that he would flit from one thing to the next, leaving hundreds of unfinished projects in his wake. Yes!
Yay!
Our hero! We understand. So one day someone's going to take that jumper that I started to make for my niece when she was 2, who's now 21.
Yeah.
That's half finished and go, this is genius. This is a masterpiece.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. Look, people praise the whole Renaissance man thing. But mm-hmm. in reality, being good at a lot of things just means that you get distracted and you can't focus. Yeah. And I do know this personally.
Oh, yeah.
Mentally.
Oh, yeah. Yep. And Leonardo got distracted a lot, like a lot. At the age of 30, he was doing sketches of executed criminals because that was the only job he could get. And it wasn't until the age of 46 that he painted The Last Supper, the painting that shot him into sudden fame and finally earned him respect in his industry. If you want proof of how much of a procrastinating perfectionist he was, the Mona Lisa took him 15 years. Off again, on again, worked complete.
And of course, the Gioconda family did not get that painting. They never got it.
And my niece never got her unfinished knitted sweater.
No. And look, just to show that we're not throwing shade on the Mona Lisa.
No.
Saying that Leonardo isn't a genius. He totally was.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
I'll just take a moment to say why the Mona Lisa is actually a great painting, because it's going to sound like we're slagging her off a little bit later.
Why not?
Yeah, we're not. So, all right. Now, this is me being a massive nerd. Okay. So, she's painted on a poplar wood panel, and Leonardo put down thick primer coat of lead white. Now, usually artists of that day would use gesso, chalk, white pigment for the primer. Using lead white as an undercoat would reflect the light and give the paint its luminosity. His glazes contained a small amount of pigment, and the shadows on her face are iron and manganese mixed to make burnt umber. He applied this glaze in about 30 fine layers in irregular brush strokes to make the skin on her face look more realistic. He has the light shining down from the top left instead of the landscape behind her, presumably so he could go to town on the shadows. He used the technique of sfumo, which is Italian for to evaporate like smoke, which is using multiple thin layers of glaze and fine shading to softly blend and blur the colors and tones so as to eliminate the lines between light areas and shaded areas. Now, this was a radical departure from traditional Italian portraiture, where the image is very clearly outlined. Also very different was the way he decided to have Lisa sitting, facing forward, looking directly at the viewer. Portraits of women usually showed the sitter in profile. To have a woman actually making eye contact with the viewer was shocking in a way we find hard to imagine today. Also strange for the time is her facial expression, hence all the hype about the smile. Women in portraits weren't given expressions or indicators of psychological depth. The smile is also an optical illusion. If you look directly at the mouth, there isn't much of a smile. But if you focus on another area of her face and look at the mouth out of the corner of your eye, she suddenly smiles. So try this with a print and it works. It's all to do with shadows and blending. Then there's the landscape behind her, which is seen from aerial view and is a type of prehistoric fantasy landscape. So it is actually a very weird, clever painting.
The landscape apparently containing a UFO too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't see that. I see that. So, yeah, the Mona Lisa is incredibly brilliant and imaginative. But like we said before, this is not why she's famous. And this isn't why hordes of tourists are crowding in front of her. She's famous because of the hype. When Leonardo died, he left it to his assistant and probable life partner, Salai, who sold it to King Francis I of France. It was kept in the French royal family until the French Revolution, when she was put in the Louvre. She then became the unlikely roommate of Napoleon Bonaparte when he decided that she should be hung in his bedroom. In 1804, she went to the Louvre, where she was basically just another painting in a room full of masterworks. There were some art historians who thought he was exceptional and important. Most people just thought she was a nice painting, if they thought about her at all. Well, this was to change in 1911, and the man who catapulted the Mona Lisa to international megastardom was a humble Italian tradesman by the name of Vincenzo Perugia. As a young man of 20, Vincenzo had left the province of Varese in Italy to escape crushing poverty and ended up in France. He became a house painter in Paris until he fell ill with lead poisoning. Now, back then, being a house painter involved mixing pure lead paste with linseed oil, and it was common for men in this trade to experience serious health problems and even brain damage from exposure to lead. Vincenzo's second bout of lead poisoning put him in hospital for 15 days, which means he would have had an enormous amount of contamination. His behaviour after this was erratic and unpredictable. Lead poisoning can shrink the prefrontal cortex of the brain and impair the ability to make careful decisions. That might account for the violent outburst that put him in prison twice, once for public drunkenness and theft, the other for brandishing a weapon and failing to show immigration papers.
Vincenzo changed professions and began working for a glazier company called Gobier. He was good at his job and trusted by his bosses, but life was hard. His workmates put salt in his wine and called him sal macaroni, meaning dirty macaroni. Aww. The anti-Italian sentiment in France was very strong at the time, with an influx of Italian migrants that were escaping poverty and a suspicion that Italy might be going to side with Germany in the war that was brewing. Vincenzo was frequently beaten up in the streets and mocked for his rudimentary knowledge of the French language. He was a hard worker, but he couldn't win the respect of the men around him, who would call out, sal macaroni, when he arrived for work each morning. Tired, lonely, and relentlessly bullied, Vincenzo was on the verge of a breakdown. Then Gobier won a contract as one of five Gobier workers sent to make glass casings for 16 of the museum's masterpieces.
The director of the Louvre had commissioned these glass casings because of two incidents of vandalism on valuable paintings. The Louvre was a very different place in the early 1900s. There was not even close to the amount of visitors that there are today, and security was lax. Most of the security guards were elderly pensioners who would fall asleep in their chairs and snore away beside the masterpieces that they were protecting. there was a joke at the time that if you saw a vandal or a thief at the Louvre, please wake up a security guard. It was when Vincenzo was working at the museum that he noticed the amount of Italian paintings on display. One day he picked up a guidebook and read about how Napoleon looted Italy, stealing many of the paintings that Vincenzo saw every day on the walls of the Louvre. He was filled with rage. The bigotry and bullying he'd received every day since coming to Paris had almost broken his spirit, but the knowledge that the Italian masterworks in front of him had been stolen gave him a fierce burst of patriotism and a determination to show everyone what a sal macaroni could do. At some point, he left his job at Gerbier and went back to painting houses, but the anger remained. 8 months later, he had a plan. He was going to take an Italian masterpiece and return it to its homeland. He, Vincenzo Perugia, would be hailed as a hero and smothered in glory and riches.
On Monday, August the 21st, 1911, Vincenzo Perugia got out of bed at 6 a.m. and put on the white smock that he had kept from his time working at the Louvre. The Louvre was closed for cleaning and maintenance on Mondays, but at 7:05, Vincenzo was able to walk straight in, his white smock making him look like any other worker that would have access on a Monday morning. Now, many accounts state that Vincenzo had shut himself in a cupboard the day before and stayed there all night, but Vincenzo refuted this in his police report. There are also accounts that he had two accomplices, but again, he always insisted that he carried out the heist alone. He entered the Salon Carrère completely unnoticed and surveyed the wall of Italian masterworks in front of him. He chose the smallest and lightest painting simply because it was the smallest and the lightest. Mm-hmm. And yes, that painting was the Mona Lisa. He took her off the four metal hooks that she was hanging from, put her under his arm, and slowly walked towards a service staircase that he'd used many times when he'd been working there. He went down the small staircase and put the Mona Lisa on the landing with some student paintings that had been left there. He checked to see if he could get out through the service door, but it was locked. He took his screwdriver out of his pocket and removed the doorknob, thinking somehow this would supposedly help him unlock the door. I don't really know what he was doing there. So anyway, he heard footsteps coming towards him and he sat down on the stairs and waited to be caught. However, the man coming towards him was a plumber who didn't recognize him and just saw a worker in a white smock. The plumber asked why the door was missing the knob, and Vincenzo said he didn't know. The plumber fiddled around with the door, got it open, and closed it behind him. So Vincenzo was still locked in. He went back upstairs where he'd left the Mona Lisa, took her out of her frame and glass casing. Now, this was easy for him to do since he was most likely the one who'd made the casing. So he removed his smock, wrapped up the unframed painting, and simply walked out of the building the way he'd arrived. Nobody looked at him. Nobody questioned him. When he was outside, he remembered he had the doorknob in his pocket and he threw it in the ditch between the fence and the wall of the Louvre. Then he got on a bus with the Mona Lisa under his arm, wrapped up, realized he was on the wrong bus, got up, hailed a horse and carriage, and went home.
You know, if I were to steal a painting, that would so be me.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
There are slightly different versions to the story, one of them being the police report of the plumber. He claimed that he actually let Vincenzo through the door with him, and he was very upset that he'd accidentally been an accomplice in the heist. However, he'd also described Vincenzo as a tall, red-headed man with a beard. And since Vincenzo was 5'3", with dark hair, a large moustache and no beard, it's probable that the plumber was thinking of somebody else. But whatever happened during the heist, we do know that Vincenzo ended up safely at home with the Mona Lisa, and the staff at the Louvre remained oblivious to her absence for the next 26 hours. The next day, a painter who happened to have been working on a copy of the Mona Lisa came in with his easel and paints, only to see a ghostly rectangle and four metal hooks.
You know, it amazes me that people could set up easels and oil paints in these major galleries back then. Because, I mean, I have often said in the NGV, which is the National Gallery of Victoria, with paper and pencils to practice drawing, but I'm not allowed to even take in watercolour. I'm only allowed to have pencil and paper. So it's just incredible to me that people could just stand there in front of these paintings with oil paint.
It just goes to show how careful they are now in comparison. So this painter goes up to a security guard and asks, "Hey, where did that Da Vinci painting go? I was working on that." The guard just told him that the photographer had probably taken it to get new photos done for postcards. At some point, somebody does ask the photographer, who says, no, they were not photographing the Mona Lisa that day. That was when pandemonium finally ensued. Visitors were suddenly and quickly ushered out. The Louvre closed its doors and the police were summoned.
Yeah, it's a bit casual.
Bit cash.
Just a bit.
Just a bit. So they have the top detectives on the job and they have a list of suspects. One is a young man who used to frequently visit the Louvre to gaze besottedly at the Mona Lisa. It is thought that he might have fallen in love with her and taken her for himself. But that lead went nowhere. Then suspicion fell on none other than Pablo Picasso. Picasso, who was in Paris at the time, had bought statues that had previously been stolen from the Louvre. He insisted that he had no idea he purchased stolen goods, and he bought them from the assistant to the poet Guillaume, also known as the poet Apollinaire. Both Picasso and the poet Apollinaire, which I'm probably pronouncing wrong, I do apologise, were hauled in for questioning and only released when Picasso agreed to return the stolen statues. So, detectives found the doorknob in the gutter and Vincenzo's fingerprints on the glass casing. Vincenzo did have his fingerprints on file from previous arrests, but matching all the fingerprints that the police had on file would have been a mammoth job. So they limited themselves to testing the prints of current Louvre workers. In the meantime, the media and the public were exploding with what could only be called Mona Lisa mania. Newspaper headlines roared out, "Where is La Gioconda?"
La Gioconda.
I can't do it. You know how suddenly you can't do it? And when I finally do it, we're both going to cheer and ruin it anyway.
Yeah, leave this in. This is funny. I like it.
So, audience, I have been trying to say this now probably for 10 minutes, and every time I just either giggle or she giggles or I just get it so badly wrong.
So we're just going to
leave it going.
Yeah.
Are you ready? We're going to do it this time.
Yeah.
Newspaper headlines roared out, "Where is La Gioconda?"
Woo! Hey!
And unimaginable. People left flowers on the steps of the Louvre. Conspiracy theorists were flying about. Was it an American multimillionaire? A German? The Kaiser? A week later, the Louvre reopened and record numbers of visitors went through the doors, only to go to the Salon Carré and stare at the four metal hooks and the empty rectangle where the Mona Lisa used to be. Yes, people who had probably never even heard of the Mona Lisa and most likely never thought about going to see her were crowding into the Louvre to stare at a blank space on a wall. Her absence had suddenly made her very precious.
This wasn't only major news in France. The theft of the Mona Lisa hit headlines worldwide, with one American newspaper showing a photo of a completely different Da Vinci painting, which kind of shows just how little people actually knew about that painting at all. And where was she while all this hysteria was happening? Propped up in a chair at the table in Vincenzo Perugia's tiny room. But don't worry, he always covered her with a linen cloth while he ate at the table. A police inspector did pay Vincenzo a visit, but he didn't search the room, not even the cupboard above the bed where Vincenzo had hidden her behind pieces of firewood. An Italian migrant with a manual job did not fit the profile the police were looking for. This was a high-class crime, obviously carried out by an educated, clever criminal. So with all the media sensationalism, newly realized public love for the painting, Vincenzo decided that he couldn't go back to Italy until the hype had died down. He got on with life, as usual, and for 2 whole years, he kept the Mona Lisa hidden in his room. Yes, just like Napoleon, the man he despised, Vincenzo had dragged La Gioconda into being his roommate. And something that's quite funny and cheeky is he used to keep a postcard of the Mona Lisa on his mantelpiece.
Oh, my. So he kept her under his bed for a time and then made a custom crate for her that had a false bottom. A girlfriend he had at the time claimed to have seen the painting, and a friend, Michael Lancelotti, even claims that he looked after the Mona Lisa while Vincenzo was making the crate.
And there are people who believe that Michael Lancelotti was the real thief and not Vincenzo Perugia. The town he came from has a whole tiny tourist industry, basically based around him being the man who stole the Mona Lisa, and they are fierce about it, so yeah. Don't try to correct
them. But can you blame them? They're trying to make a tourism industry around it. So Vincenzo writes to an antiques dealer in Florence called Alfredo Geri, and in his letter he states outright that he has the real honest-to-goodness dinky dye Mona Lisa and would Geri like to buy it. He signs it Leonardo V. On December the 13th, 1913, he holds a goodbye dinner at a cafe for his friends and tells them that he is on a mission that will bring him fame and fortune. The next day, he puts Mona Lisa in the crate, places the false bottom over her, then piles in his clothes, tools, and mandolin. Then he catches the train to Florence.
The crate is checked at the border, but they don't notice the false bottom, and Vincenzo is given the all clear. He checks into a hotel and goes straight to Alfredo Geri's gallery. He tells Geri that the Mona Lisa is in his hotel room and would he like to see. So they engage in a bit of haggling, and Geri agrees that if this is the real Mona Lisa, then he'll pay 500,000 lira. He agrees to go to the hotel the next day.
The next day, Geri took Giovanni Poggi, director of the Uffizi Gallery, with him to Vincenzo's hotel. Vincenzo opened up the crate, threw his clothes out onto the floor, lifted up the false bottom, and took out the painting. Poggi took her back with him to the Uffizi Gallery, where she was inspected and verified as the real deal. Then he called the police. Vincenzo was arrested and taken to prison.
When the news broke that the Mona Lisa was in Italy, there was, once again, Mona Lisa mania. Vincenzo was seen as a hero, but he was in prison and didn't get to enjoy the glory. Mona Lisa merchandise was being sold everywhere. The painting was exhibited in the Uffizi, and more than 30,000 people went through the door in the first 4 hours.
Wow.
There was even a riot outside the gallery that was started by people who couldn't get in. So after a week, the Mona Lisa was sent back to Rome and handed in to the French ambassador. See, the saddest irony of all was that of all the paintings he could have chosen, Vincenzo took the one that was legally owned by France. So if you'll remember, the French King Francis first bought it outright. So it wasn't loot. It wasn't Napoleonic loot. So it had to go back.
So we know what happened to the Mona Lisa, but what happened to Vincenzo? He was sentenced to 1 year and 15 days in prison, but only served 7 months and 8 days. World War I broke out soon after his release, and he went to war. He was captured and spent 2 years in a prisoner of war camp in Austria. He did at some point return to Paris with his new wife. He went under a new name because he wasn't actually allowed in France, and he took his wife to the Louvre to see the Mona Lisa.
You know, I wonder if it was like seeing an old girlfriend.
Is it possible he fell in love with her a little bit? Maybe. Can you imagine, like, you know, we've said, I don't want to go see her if she's, you know, in a room full of sweaty tourists. But if I had her under my bed for 2 years, just quietly looking at her. I mean, he's probably the one man in history, apart from Leonardo, who spent the most time with her.
And Napoleon.
Oh, and Napoleon. Yeah. I think Napoleon might have been a bit more distracted from what I've heard
about him. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If it was in his bedroom. But anyway.
Anyway.
Anyway, he died of a heart attack in 1929, just as his two-year-old daughter, Celestina, was walking towards him.
And there is a beautiful documentary that you can find on YouTube by First Hand Films called Mona Lisa is Missing, The Man Who Stole the Mona Lisa. And in this documentary, the film crew traveled to Italy to meet with Vincenzo's family, and his grandson reenacts the heist. And it's just a really charming documentary. He does, yeah. I mean, the whole family is just adorable. And the daughter, Celestine, is just the sweetest lady and gives a lot of insights about the family. And yeah, it is a really, really lovely documentary. And it of the source that I used as the definitive source, because there are so many different versions of that heist story. And even some really reputable art historians still tell this other version that there was an American multimillionaire who used Perugia as his fall guy. But that's been completely disputed.
I choose to still believe it was Picasso just because I want to be Astropolis. So
I know. I'm not a big fan of Picasso. No. I understand how important he was. Mm. I understand what a genius he was, but I just still don't like him.
No, he wasn't a great guy.
No.
He wasn't a great guy.
No.
So if you think about it, if Vincenzo had never got it into his head to take the Mona Lisa, she would have never been as famous as she is.
No, absolutely not.
Do you think another artwork would have taken her place, or do you think this is like just a very unique phenomenon?
Do you know, it's impossible to say. It really is. But we do keep making images iconic, so maybe there would have been something else there that
came
that way.
Think of other artworks that are iconic. The screen
that's
been stolen twice. Well, two different versions of it been stolen. Yeah. What else is iconic? Wasn't Sunflowers stolen by Van Gogh? It was another one. It was Poppies.
Oh, okay.
Do you know, maybe to become iconic, you have to be stolen. Heidi, would you like me to steal some of your artwork?
Oh, do it.
Okay.
Do it.
I'm going to do it, and I'm going to catch a bus and then break down the bus and get on a bike.
Even better, a kidnapping. Kidnap me.
Oh, no way. You'd be too much trouble. You'd be too bad. You would give me such a hard time. I just know it. Although we'd have fun.
I'd be quite difficult.
You would be difficult.
I'd be a bit of a diva.
You would not be a great hostage.
No, I wouldn't. Talking about hostages, we will release you.
Yes, you are released. It's an interesting story. We hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And thank you, Vincenzo, for giving us a really cool story about the Mona Lisa. I think it's more interesting than the Mona Lisa itself.
Yeah. everybody, for listening, and we hope to see you soon.
Bye.
Bye.